Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Gloria Steinem is an author, activist, and inspiration to anyone who aspires to a day when there will be full equality for women. Her honors and accomplishments are too numerous to mention here. I will mention a few. Co-founder of Ms. Magazine, co-founder of the Women's Action Alliance and the National Women's Political Caucus, author of Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, Moving Beyond Words, and Marilyn Norma Jean, all bestsellers. And at present, she's at work on Road to the Heart, America as If Everyone Mattered, which is a book about her more than 30 years on the road as a feminist organizer. She will be the keynote speaker for MTSU's celebration of National Women's History Month on March the 2nd in the Tennessee Room of the James Union Building at 4:30 p.m. A reception and book signing will follow, and it's all free and open to the public. And speaking with us today via telephone is Gloria Steinem. We're very thrilled to have you on the show. Thank you.
And I am, too, and I'm looking forward to the second.
I am as well. Since the economy is the topic that just seems to overwhelm all others these days, let's start with a money question. The New York Times is reporting that 82% of the job losses since the recession started have hit men. Do you think that men are being laid off in such disproportionate figures because women still earn only 77 cents to the dollar that men make, and therefore the company can save more money? Or is it more about the types of jobs that are most affected by the recession?
I think it's more about the types of jobs, though the types of jobs are also better paid. So if you think about manufacturing or home construction, office construction, the higher-paid blue-collar jobs and white-collar jobs, those are disproportionately held by men. And the so-called pink-collar ghetto, that is service jobs, waitressing, nursing, and also, you know, less professional service jobs, are more than 70% held by women. So because categorically manufacturing and construction and so on have been cut, more men have lost their jobs and, you know, higher paying per se. We need to look at the cost of that, because often these men and women are in the same family. So what that means is that the family is now subsisting on the much lower salary of the woman, and she is probably, statistically speaking, has two jobs anyway. You know, she's more responsible for taking care of the home and working outside the home. So I don't think this is a competition of tears here. You know, we're not trying to say who suffered more. We're trying to cure the suffering altogether.
And generally speaking, the family as a whole would suffer even more from the fact, would they not, that women's health insurance costs more and women are taxed disproportionately?
Yes. The so-called gender rating on insurance means that women pay up to 40% more for their insurance, for instance. And we had hoped to get rid of that in this new health care legislation that was proposed. Of course, it hasn't passed. But the insurance companies managed to get it back again. So gender rating is back. It makes no sense, because whether one is male or female is less an indicator than whether one smokes or not. And you can't use racial indicators anymore, racial rating, which insurance companies used to use, but you can still use gender rating.
Is this recession setting back efforts by women to institute more family-friendly workplace policies like telecommuting, on-site daycare, flex time, things like that?
You know, I don't think we have any good figures yet on what's happening. I know as I travel, I see that many workers, men and women, are ingeniously and creatively asking for job improvements that don't cost money. So sometimes they are able to get more family-friendly policies instead of a raise. And that certainly is a very good tactic, because it's good for everybody. It's good for the employer, who doesn't spend any more money and gets the same amount of productivity, and it's certainly good for families. But I don't think, you know, we have good statistics on that.
Conversely, with regard to employment, the unemployment rate being high, is a woman seeking a job in this depressed market possibly more likely to get a job because an employer looking to save money figures, oh, I can pay her less. She's a woman.
Well, you know, I don't think we've shown that yet either, you know, because the fact that more men have lost their jobs doesn't mean that more women seeking jobs get them, if you see what I mean.
Right.
I mean, I think the percentage of women seeking jobs has not really changed that much, you know, perhaps because we're talking about different jobs here.
Let's talk now about, if we could, the jobs held by our men and women in the military and society's changing or not changing attitudes toward sexual orientation. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, recently testified before a congressional committee in favor of dumping Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And there is a new Washington Post ABC News poll that indicates that three-quarters of Americans support openly gay people serving in the armed forces, or they would be okay with it. Do you think the gay community is on the verge of a breakthrough in this area?
I do. I really do. And I think on marriage equality, too. That is a huge change in attitude, you know, over the last, say, quarter century. And I think at bottom, what is really the credit for it is the gay community itself, because by coming out, that is, by being open about one's own life, the gay community, women and men, have shown Americans that gay people, lesbians and gay men, are their children and their congresspeople and their dentist and their friends and their professor, you know, so because what has been shown statistically to make the biggest difference in the attitudes of the public is whether or not they actually know a gay person. I remember because I travel so much, I remember seeing maybe 20 years ago the beginning or 15 years ago the beginning of this, because gay couples with and without children decided to invite their state legislators home to dinner. And I think, you know, that kind of effort, you know, everything is about knowing each other. You know, Alice Walker says that friendship is the key to world peace. You know, when we know each other across national boundaries and across continents and really can communicate and be friends and talk to each other, that's the way to world peace. I think that's right, and I think that this is an example of that.
And isn't it interesting that some men are very dismissive of employing the personal touch, if you will, because they perceive it as a feminine value?
Yes, well, that is a great problem. It's one of the ways in which the genderization of subjects as well as people penalizes everybody, women and men. For instance, whenever I'm on a campus, as I will when I come there too, I always ask, is there a course on this campus that relates family forms and the way children are raised to the governmental forms, foreign policy, public structures, public violence, and so on? And I have never yet found one, because family structures, you know, are families democratic or not, how are children raised, is a subject that's thought of as feminine. And governmental forms, governance, foreign policy, you know, how government problems are solved, conflicts, wars, that's thought of as a masculine subject. And never the twain meet, which is a huge penalty, because the first causes the second. I mean, the biggest indicator of whether there's violence in society is whether there's violence in the home. The biggest indicator of whether we have a democracy is whether we have democratic families. And you can see that, you know, in history. You can see that a major reason Hitler got elected in the National Socialist era was because the family form, the normal family form, was authoritarian, and it trained people that they needed a strong leader, that they could not make their own decisions and govern themselves. You know, there are just countless examples.
Is there a need for more empirical research in this area, or is the research there and we're just ignoring it?
No, the research is there. We certainly don't need any more research, but we just need to stop genderizing and dividing and categorizing and making hierarchies. We need to start linking rather than ranking.
The demographic gap in the Washington Post ABC News poll on gays in the military is really huge, but men and seniors, it shows, are far less likely than women and young adults to say they support it. So apparently a great many people still feel threatened by the possibility that don't ask, don't tell might go by the wayside.
Yes, well, that's gender, too, because masculinity, the concept of masculinity, which is completely constructed, like the concept of femininity, is much more likely to be threatened by playing a so-called feminine role. So the idea that any man could play a feminine role by being in love with another man is extremely threatening to them. And it's not so threatening to women, because the idea of a man playing a feminine role is per se not as threatening.
Even though gay actors, male and female alike, have been playing straight roles on stage and in movies for eons.
Yes, absolutely, and vice versa. Yes, certainly.
Since you're a communicator through all kinds of media, I'd like to get your perspective on the best way, in terms of media, for feminists to reach a mass audience. And how is digital technology affecting those types of decisions?
Well, you know, we are trying, doing our best at the Women's Media Center to address exactly your question by every means we can possibly employ. For instance, we are training women who are experts in many, many areas, no shortage of expertise. But when you look at the public intellectuals or, the people who are interviewed on television, there's a very small percentage of women. Now, some of that is because the networks, the mainstream folks, just don't know the people. So we try to, we have huge lists of experts and so on. We have a big list called She Source, so you can find an expert on anything, a female expert, diverse female experts. And we also try to help train, through a program called Progressive Women's Voices, individual women. But, of course, that's only one way of doing it, because it's using the mainstream. As you point out, it's terribly important that we use all the new means of communicating with each other on the web, and we do that, too. For instance, during the recent Super Bowl, we had a Super Bowl watching party in the Women's Media Center office, which was on stream online, and people could call in, and we all watched together, particularly because of the advertising and the male bias of the advertising, and especially because there were four particular ads about a woman who had said she had been advised to have an abortion for medical reasons, had not had it, and had given birth to a football player who had won two Heisman trophies. You know, well, we were trying to say, fine, and we certainly should support her choice, but to support only one choice doesn't mean you're supporting choice.
The ad that you refer to is, of course, featured Tim Tebow and his mother, and it was paid for by Focus on the Family. Has CBS come up with a cogent explanation for why it refused to air an ad for a gay dating service, but it agreed to air an ad that's clearly issue-oriented and has political overtones?
Not to my knowledge, and I think from a freedom of press point of view or a freedom of speech point of view, obviously they should have accepted both. From a right-wing political, patriarchal, you might say, political point of view, what they did made sense, because the right-wing groups are against any form of sexuality that cannot end in conception. So they would be both against, say, family planning and sex between two women or two men. So in some sense, CBS was politically consistent, but for freedom of speech, wildly inconsistent.
And what about the other Super Bowl commercials? I watch the Super Bowl every year, and it just seemed to me, or maybe I was more cognizant of it, that the commercials took, or more of the commercials took, a really misogynistic tone this year. The ads for Dodge and Bridgestone and Budweiser and Dove for Men all attempted to sell their products by communicating that if you're emasculated by the woman in your life, you can re-empower yourself by buying their products.
Yes, I know. I mean, they're selling they're selling masculinity, which of course really doesn't exist. We're all human beings, but this artificial construct is what they're selling. It's the opposite side of saying that your life will be fixed if you're a female and you use a particular kind of makeup or, you know, attract men in a certain way.
This year, more so than any other, it seems like, though, it made me wonder if all of those people went to the same ad agency, the one for Dodge in particular, in which the male voiceover says things like, I carried your lip gloss for you, I put down the seat for you, I did this for you, I put up with that for you, ipso facto, I can go out and buy the car I want to, so there. And I'm sitting there thinking, who writes this stuff, a 12-year-old? This sounds really immature.
I missed that one. I'm so glad that you identified that. You're absolutely right. There also were a lot of commercials in which there were only men, and also the commercial including the Tebow one that you mentioned, and including another one, showed men tackling women and knocking them down.
Yes.
One was an old woman, and actually Pam Tebow was tackled by her son.
Oh, yeah, that's right, in that commercial. And then there was the Snickers commercial in which Betty White was getting knocked down.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, right. I mean, that's a little odd. You know, it's completely unrealistic. A tackle is extremely damaging to the human being getting tackled. And, in fact, perhaps you noticed this, too, that a study has just come out saying that for 20 years they've been suppressing the amount of brain damage that results to football players themselves and the premature senility that results from the brain damage.
And the NFL has been in denial about concussions for a long, long time, despite the fact that there is human evidence to the contrary still alive, and those human beings live diminished lives.
Concussions, you know, sounds like a one-time injury, but it's also gradual deterioration that means that, you know, at 40 or 50, you have the brain of an 80-year-old, and it's tragic.
Is that a product of gender construction too? Intentionally or unintentionally, that to take a more safety-conscious attitude toward concussions and the frequency with which you send a player back into the game after a player has suffered a concussion is unmasculine.
Yes, it is, because masculinity, the concept, the cult of masculinity, is the way in which men are encouraged, forced, humiliated into risking their lives. You know, it's the way men have been forced or encouraged to go to war and be wounded or perhaps even killed. It's the way they're got into fight situations and speeding and guns. And, you know, we once tried to figure out statistically at a Ms. Magazine editorial meeting to what extent the masculine role killed men. And so we took the statistics of the causes of male death and deducted the ones that could be attributed to the masculine role: speeding, guns, violence, tension-related diseases, and so on. And it turned out that if you deducted those, men and women lived less than a year apart differently. Women only lived a year longer than men as opposed to 8 years. So I always say to men, you know, the women's movement has 4 years of extra life to offer you. Nobody else can make that offer.
I alluded to it earlier with the poll on gays in the military and with the commercials as well, taking a very juvenile tone as though they were appealing to a teenage audience almost. There seems to be a generational gap in some people's understanding. Do you perceive a difference in the generations and how they react to gender roles, or are young people necessarily not as prey to falling into gender stereotypes in their own minds as their elders?
I do think there's a big generational difference, and you can see it by measuring the attitudes toward gays in the military or gay marriage, young people in general are much more accepting and sometimes, you know, don't even understand why we're asking the question. But, of course, within any generation, there is also a great variance because it depends on the homes in which we were raised and what, therefore, feels like home to us. You know, so we can't totally generalize about generations any more than we can generalize about human beings in any other way. But you can observe from the public opinion polls that there has been a drastic, drastic change in racial attitudes and attitudes about gender and attitudes about whether or not war is ever justified or ever useful as a way of solving problems. You know, a big difference.
You know, I interviewed the officers of our university's Women's Studies Student Organization. They're all from, all three of them are from small towns in Tennessee, one in West Tennessee, two in Middle Tennessee. And all of them, to a woman, say that just the simple fact of being in college and taking women's studies classes has opened up their minds enormously. One of them told me they didn't know who you were until they came to college and read about you.
Well, you know, that's okay. Sometimes a mother will say to me, oh, I'm so upset because my daughter doesn't know who you are. And I always say, that's okay. Does she know who she is? That's the point. You know. But it is true that female human beings are generally left out of our textbooks, and they're not very likely to tell us about the ethnic history and the racial history of the country either. So, you know, we desperately need women's studies and African American studies and gay and lesbian studies and Native American studies and, you know, all the things we really should call remedial studies.
Mm-hmm.
So that we are studying human history. We need them from the moment we start learning, not just by the time we get to university.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. What more can we do to ensure that these sorts of things are integrated into the public school, the K-12 curricula?
Well, you know, we really need to look at what we are learning. For instance, I only about 20 years ago came to understand that the suffrage movement, and to a large extent the abolitionist movement too, was inspired by and supported by the many Native American cultures on this continent. In the case of suffrage, it was clear that the women in many of the 500 or so Native cultures were very equal, that they participated in decision-making, that they controlled their own fertility, that they, if the chief was male, the female elders chose the chief and could depose the chief. Sometimes the chief was female. And that seeing those cultures inspired, especially, say, in upstate New York, where the Seneca women had dinner every Sunday night with suffragists, you know, was what inspired the suffrage movement. Now, that is still not in the textbooks.
I wonder if that runs true across all tribes, or if the degree varies from tribe to tribe.
It does, but it's much more true. I mean, most of the tribes, you know, in some cases, the history has been covered up, and you know, many of my friends who are from the Cherokees or, you know, many different tribes are themselves just uncovering their own history. But generally speaking, the tribes, they were matrilineal cultures. That is, the clan passed down and the identity passed through the mother. The husband moved into the household of the woman, for instance, and her older brother played a great role in raising the child. You know, it was just a much more egalitarian culture. And I've been reading the comments and letters home from the Europeans who've arrived early, and they are shocked by this. Shocked, you know, they're shocked because the native groups don't beat their children. They say, you know, this is awful. Children are little evil spirits. spirits and animals, they have to be beaten into submission. Why do these people not beat their children? There was even a directive from the Queen of Spain saying that native cultures here bathe too much too often. It was very bad for their health. Meanwhile, the native groups couldn't believe how bad the Europeans smelled.
Colonialism, it makes you think about who the real savages were and who was just being labeled a savage.
And these, especially the Iroquois Confederacy and those, seven nations, but many others too, were in fact the inspiration for democracy, and the Confederacy itself was the model for our Constitution. So the idea that democracy came from Greece, which had slavery and did not include women in any way, is much less accurate than its inspiration here.
I'd like to ask a question that's inspired by some of the women I've encountered in academia, not all of them certainly, but when I talk to some women about the brick walls we face in the university community and some of the paternalistic and condescending attitudes we face, they express the view, not in so many words, but that if they can educate the students properly with their energy and their optimism, they can bring about the changes we hope to see. But some of them have practically given up on doing things themselves in the here and now for women in the here and now, as if it's just to be an accepted fact that it's impossible. So with the understanding that we all care about the future, of course, is there anything you'd like to say to those women who think that all we can do is pass on the torch?
I respect their efforts and what they're doing for the students. But with all respect, I think we have to remember that the way we teach best is by example. You know, we do what we see much more than what we're told. So the best thing they can do for students is to provide an example of making change themselves.
And that means they're going to have to keep knocking their heads against those brick walls.
Right. And actually, it's fun.
Concussions notwithstanding from knocking your head against a brick wall.
No, we're much more like the football players are getting concussions. We're having a good time, I think, even though it's angering and discouraging and frustrating. It's for making progress, and it creates a community of people making progress.
On the cover of the fall edition of Ms. Magazine, it's a picture of you and your friend Alice Walker, the author of The Color Purple. You must have been really elated by the poem that she wrote in your honor.
I was. That was one of the most moving things that's ever happened to me, because I'm trying to remember how long ago it was, maybe a couple of years ago. I was interviewing Alice at the YMHA here, which has a long series of great programs and distinguished author series and so on. And in the beginning of the program, she was reading that poem, and I had no idea. You know, I was just very struck by it, but only at the end did I learn it was about me. I'll never forget that moment as long as I live.
You didn't know the whole
no.
time she was reading it?
No. Mm-mm.
Oh, wow. I can't think of a nicer gift.
Yes, I can't either. Right.
Gloria Steinem will be the keynote speaker, as we said, for MTSU's celebration of National Women's History Month on March the 2nd in the Tennessee Room of the James Union Building, which is here on campus. And it's appropriate that it'll be in the Tennessee Room, because that's the only room big enough to hold everyone who's going to want to be there. 4:30 p.m. is the time. There will be a reception to follow and a book signing. Which book? Any and all of the above? All of your books?
Anything they wish to buy, yeah. Right.
Anything.
Yeah.
And it's all free and open to the public. And I really appreciate you taking the time, Ms. Steinem, to talk with us today. It's been a complete delight having you on the program.
Yes, and thank you. And thank you for the information about the other Super Bowl commercial now.
Oh.
That's really interesting. Thank you.
Oh, no problem. Go look it up on YouTube.
I will.
You will be appalled.
Okay.
This is MTA.
I look forward to meeting you.
Thank you. Same here. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we invite you to join us again at this same time next Sunday, 8 a.m. Central Time. And don't forget, you can catch the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.